You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
I am so excited about this passage today because these Advent passages are sometimes like, where in the heck did they come up with these? And this particular passage is one that requires me to go back into teacher mode, which I hope you'll bear with me for just a moment, because it's really important to know the context of this passage. When I arrived in seminary, and I think when you arrive as a student at any mainline or Roman Catholic seminary, one of the first things that you are thrown into the deep end, is the history of the ancient Near East. And at first you're thinking, what? And then you realize, oh my gosh, what I didn't know. What I didn't know that is so important for us to actually understand what's in the Bible, how it is represented, and what bearings it has on our lives today. It's important to be able to put the stories of the Jewish people into context. And wow, it is not just dusty, dry history. It's rich, it's complex, there's drama and intrigue and double crosses and all kinds of juicy stuff. It makes what's going on in our world right now kind of pale in comparison. I mean, what the crazy stuff they were able to get up to without the technology we have is pretty amazing. And it not only helps the Bible make more sense, but when you compare our ego as a country that is less than 250 years old with the accomplishment of these empires that lasted thousands of years and controlled vast swaths of the world, it really is an exercise in humility. So Micah, the prophet that we're looking at today, comes from a really turbulent time in the history of the Jews, who in the biblical version have already cracked up into two different kingdoms after Solomon's death. And it's really important to realize that the archaeological evidence and the biblical evidence are two differing kind of things. But going with the biblical evidence, you can see where there were two different kingdoms. The northern kingdom of Israel was made up of basically 10 of the major tribes, and the southern kingdom, was Judah, headquartered in Jerusalem. Israel was headquartered in Samaria. There was lots of fear and unrest in the southern kingdom, which was Judah. And there were all kinds of internal rebellions afoot in the northern kingdom. I mean, yeah, 10 different tribes, all jockeying for authority and power over everybody else. But what made for all of this internal conflict and unrest? Well, speaking for God, Micah makes it pretty clear. Micah says that it's the oppression of the weak by the upper class that is the problem. The powerful and the wealthy elites, especially the politicians and the priests, right? We're the problem. The powerful and the wealthy are being warned by Micah all through this book that unless things change, there will be a judgment. So now, like any good story, enter the instrument of God's judgment. Dun, dun, dun! The Assyrian Empire. Now, Assyria has been in the news just of late because ISIS has been hard at work desecrating these World Heritage Sites that document the incredible history of the Assyrian Empire over 3,000 years ago. Here's one of the winged deities of the Assyrians being chopped up with a jackhammer. This is what one of them looks like at the Louvre in Paris. Just unbelievable culture there in the Assyrian Empire. In Jerusalem, let's cut back to Jerusalem now. Hezekiah, who is king, is playing a really dangerous game. He is already a puppet king of the Assyrians, So he's taking his orders from the Assyrians, but Egyptian influence over Jewish culture and politics were really, really strong. So check out this bulla, this clay seal that was just discovered this year in a garbage dump outside of Jerusalem. And for those of you that aren't familiar with ancient Hebrew, right there it basically says across the top, this belongs to King Hezekiah. That's what it says. This would have been sealed on like a jar handle or on a document or something like that. But it's not the text. This is like, you know, when you put your name in your shirt collar when you go to camp, right? That's what this is. But look at the graphics. What are those? Can you recognize any of those symbols? What's that in the center? It is a winged sun. What do you see over the entrance of all the temples in Egypt? Right? A winged sun. What is that over on the far right? An ankh. If you look at any of the pharaohs in their formal portraits, what are the pharaohs holding? An ankh. So what is a vassal king of Assyria doing with these Egyptian symbols on his official seal? Well, there was trouble afoot. And when the Assyrian king Sargon was killed in battle, Hezekiah took this as his go time because it kind of busted up the myth that the Assyrians were completely invincible. And so Hezekiah was one of the first ones to raise his hand and say, okay, Assyria, you know. This was a very bad move politically. He probably did it because he was getting encouragement from his Egyptian allies who said, we got your back, buddy. Not knowing that Sennacherib, Sargon's son, was worse than Sargon. And he swooped down with all the vengeance that you can imagine, completely wiped out the Egyptian allies, and then came up and crushed the Jews. When Sennacherib annihilated the northern kingdom, it spread out the 10 tribes so much, it just broke them up so that they would never, ever come back together again as their individual tribes. And eventually Judah was also destroyed, and Jerusalem only survived by promising to pay these huge sums of tribute tax on a regular basis. In among all of these oracles of judgment, where Micah is saying, this is happening, you guys are done, it's going to be worse than you could ever imagine, is our little passage today. And it's one of the passages that gets trotted out every Christmas. It's one of the only oracles of hope in Micah. It's an oracle of salvation to what he hopes is going to be a remnant people, a promise of a new ruler like David before, who would come from Bethlehem, the smallest, good-for-nothing little nowhere that anyone could think of. I mean, Bethlehem is like Ajo in Arizona, right? Right? If you're in Arizona, you know where Ajo is. For Methodist pastors, that's where we kid one another that if you screw up, that's where the bishop is going to send you, is be at Ajo. So here this king is coming from nowhere. And early Christian writers, most famously the authors of the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, picked up on this prediction and said, aha, there's some proof of who Jesus is. So let's take a listen to this passage from Micah, and let's wish Joan luck with some of these pronunciations.
But you, O Bethlehem of Ephrathah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to rule in Israel, whose origin is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has brought forth. Then the rest of his kindred shall return to the people of Israel, and he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall live secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be the one of peace. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Let's pray. Loving and gracious Spirit, for these words of encouragement from a context that both seems far away and very, very close. We're grateful. May we hear these words in a way that our hearts might be moved. And as we consider our call to be followers of Jesus, might be a part of helping none of us leave this place unchanged. We gather this day as followers of Jesus. Amen. When I was in seminary back in 1980, I had the chance to go to the Holy Land over the Christmas break. And it is one of the most life-changing experiences that I can point to, not the least of which is because we were in Jerusalem and had the chance to go to Bethlehem for Christmas Eve. So we were pretty stoked. We had the days off there so that we could do whatever we wanted. So some colleagues and I decided to take the bus to Bethlehem. That was the only way you could get there because security was so high. So we made our way to the bus station at Jerusalem, and we had to go through metal detectors, and we had to go in these little booths where we got a full, very thorough pat-down before we were even allowed to go to the ticket booth to get a ticket. Once we were on the bus, I got that seat, that really prime seat right there behind the little stairs that's halfway back along the bus. So I'm sitting there, so there's just nobody right in front of me, right? Well, then a bunch of these teenagers get on with the IDF, and they're in their full Israeli Defense Forces uniforms with the Uzi slung over their shoulder and everything. And one of them in broken English comes to me and says, you know, indicates they want me to move back a seat because they need to put the field radio into my seat so they can put the whip antenna out the window. And as they're doing this, you know, their Uzis are clanging around in front of my face, and I'm sitting there, I guess, looking a little distressed. And one of the kids turns around to me with a smile and says, "Commando bus," which didn't help my mood at all. It took us about a half an hour to drive down to Bethlehem. And this was before the Berlin-style wall that separates Arabs and Jews now. So we could just drive right up to the front part of Bethlehem. And as we were disgorged from the bus, we were facing more metal detectors and more pat-downs before we could even get into Manger Square. And once we got there, it was nothing like any of us expected. It was like everybody had been invited. The place was absolutely chock-a-block with people. There were choirs from all over the world trying to out-sing one another. You've never heard Silent Night sung when you're trying to sing it louder than the next choir over. It was so jam-packed that people could hardly move. And to top it off, the whole square was surrounded by Jeeps with 50 caliber machine guns mounted on them. You remember Rat Patrol? Do you remember that? That kind of thing? So you had all these Jeeps surrounding, and you had these guys standing behind machine guns watching you, and you had snipers along all the tops of the buildings. It really kind of took the shine off of Christmas Eve. And then to add insult to injury and irony, it's that only the elite with VIP tickets were going to be allowed into the Church of the Nativity that night. The hoi polloi were not welcome. So it didn't take long for us to tire of this, and my colleagues and I bailed out of Bethlehem on Christmas Eve. We took a cab back to Talpiot, our dorm there, and it was on the southern end of Jerusalem anyway. So once we'd had our kosher pizza for a Christmas Eve banquet, we decided to go out for a walk and see what we could find. So we just headed south. It didn't take long for the asphalt to give way to dirt road, and pretty soon we were out in these open fields with a beautiful starlit night. And as we made our way, we started to cut across some of these fields, and we saw this hill that we thought we could climb up on and maybe get a good view of the things around us. Well, as we clambered up on top of that hill, it turned out to instead be a dilapidated, falling apart pillbox that had been part of the walls that separated the West Bank from Israel in the original 49 armistice. And so here we are. We find ourselves sitting on top of this pillbox with the lights of Jerusalem behind us, the glow of Bethlehem in front of us. There really weren't words to express the kind of feelings that came over us. And we sat there just in silence with our own thoughts about being here in this place that for so many reasons was so significant, not only in history, but in our own imaginations and in our own faith journey. And so as I sat there, the kind of hectic scene that we'd left behind in Bethlehem and had abandoned for our pillbox made it kind of like a spiritual whiplash that night. But it also made for an unforgettable moment of kind of out-of-timeness. And not a Christmas goes by that I don't think back about that experience. It wasn't particularly holy. It wasn't mystical, but it was one of those moments that was almost hyper-real, where every breath, everything surrounding me seemed extra rich and deeper, and I felt a connection. And I think that what I was experiencing was something that I didn't have a name for until years later, but that had been observed and pointed out by Celtic Christians for centuries. And that was that they believed that heaven was not somewhere far away, but that heaven is right here with us. It's like another parallel dimension that is right here, except it is separated from us by a veil. Most of the time, that veil is about the thickness of concrete block. But sometimes there are places and moments where that veil becomes gossamer thin so that you can almost sense a glimmer of something more beyond just here and now. Another place that is famous for its spiritual vibe is the Isle of Iona off the west coast of Scotland. And there, on the site of the 13th century abbey, is the site of the 6th century monastery founded by St. Columba. St. Columba brought Christianity. He and his monks were run out of Ireland, and they came and brought Christianity to Scotland. And it was here on this site that the first Celtic cross was introduced, if you've ever seen that. And this is an unbelievable place. For centuries, countless pilgrims have made their way to Iona for renewal and to get in touch with a sense of this something more. And I got to tell you, in 2009, when I had a chance to visit there, by the time you take the plane, the train, the bus, the boat, another bus, and finally another boat to get there, you're so delirious, you are primed for a religious experience. It is quite a difficult place to get to even today. But I've come more or less to be unsatisfied with this idea of a veil that separates earth and heaven, like earth is something bad or unholy. Because isn't it creation itself? Isn't it every day, every moment, where we have our only opportunity to actually encounter the divine? After all, didn't Elizabeth Barrett Browning write, "Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries." Right? Can we see the holy, which is beyond just the blackberries? Along these same lines, Trappist monk Thomas Merton once wrote that thin places are a way that is more prevalent than the Celtic Christians ever believed. But most of us just don't see them. Paraphrase just a bit. He says, "Life is simple. We are living in a world that is absolutely transparent, and the divine is shining through it all the time. If we abandon ourselves to the more and forget ourselves, we see it sometimes. The only thing is that we don't let ourselves see it. We miss those glimpses of the kingdom of God breaking in on earth, which is ironic given the fact that every Sunday and in many other occasions we're always praying the prayer that Jesus taught us, that we might see the kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven, right? Wow, even in the midst of the very real threat of foreign invasion and their disillusion as a people, the prophet Micah called the people of Judah to look at their fears and look beyond them and know that the divine was not far away. But neither was it to be found in an expected place. Mind you, very few, if any, of the people that heard Micah's prophecies about all of this would ever experience anything close to redemption or restoration. There was nothing but grief and doom for these people for a number of generations. But Micah was laying the groundwork for a people to be ready to embrace something other than the status quo. Remember, the Jews had already divided into two very disagreeable factions, right? The northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. They hated one another. They mistrusted one another. They could not say anything good about the other. And their inability to see that their fates were inextricably linked to one another, and more importantly, to the fate of those who were least among them, was the guarantee of their doom. I don't know about you, but does that sound like any other country you're familiar with right now? Right? Two disagreeable factions who cannot even come to an agreement on the simplest of things. Now, Micah is basically saying it's too late. It's too late to avoid the consequences. But there's hope. Just please, you've seen it doesn't work. Chariots and armies are not the solution. You've seen that walls separating us are not the answer. Micah says you've seen that grasping at your own security at the expense of others is not the answer. The future belongs to one who takes, as he says in the passage this morning, a posture of peace, where security is gained in coming together as one people, despite our differences. Micah was harking back to the legend of David, who, for all of his shortcomings as a person and as a king, people saw him as someone who was able to unite all the people together into one kingdom. So Micah is saying, let's look to Bethlehem again. Humble and obscure Bethlehem. Maybe there. Maybe there. You can see why both Matthew and Luke jumped on that line of thinking as a prediction of Jesus coming. But while I'm convinced that Micah was in no way predicting Jesus, it was the gospel writers that made it look that way, Micah was on to something that we still need to hear. It is the most unexpected places, the most pedestrian of situations, the most everyday circumstances in which we encounter the divine. Because those are the only places we can. The way we look at it during Christmas is exactly what Micah was saying. We look, oh, look at the newborn baby. Aren't they cute? They're a symbol of hope, aren't they? They're a symbol of something good possible in the future. And it doesn't have to be a holy child, right? It's any child, right? We're overcome with that possibility. I mean, it's any child. If you don't believe me, try and tell a new parent that you're unimpressed with their baby because you doubt she'll amount to anything. Right? Look, we don't have to go anywhere. We don't have to go to Bethlehem. We don't have to go to Iona. We don't have to go to the maternity ward. Paraphrasing Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, He says, being awake is something to aspire to every day. Being awake. Despite being in the midst of the ordinary rush of life, he brings us our stream of thought for today. Normal consciousness is a state of stupor. I'm looking out at this crowd right now. All right. A lot of stuporificness going on out there. Normal consciousness is a state of stupor in which the awareness of the real and responsiveness to the spirit are reduced. The mystics, and I hope that is all of us, endeavor to awake from that drowsiness and apathy and to regain the state of wakefulness for their enchanted souls. Are you feeling enchanted yet? In the midst of all the preparations for Christmas, we can be caught up in the same traditions, the same obligations, many of them self-imposed, that require all of our attention. And we miss the fact that Christmas really calls us to consider a thin place that is not really a place at all, but a way of living every single day. In a sarcastic little poem, How to Be a Poet, Wendell Berry gives some great life advice. He says, first, you've got to sit down in silence, but the place where you sit is of vital importance. Are you ready? First of all, breathe with an unconditional breath, the unconditioned air. Shun electric wire. Communicate slowly. Live a three-dimensional life, which means stay away from screens of all kinds. Stay away from anything that obscures the place that it is in. There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places, some of which have been desecrated. So here we are, a couple of thousand years later, a couple of thousand years shy of the gravitas of a place like Bethlehem or Iona. But we don't need to go there. Right here, right now, especially in a crazy hectic season like this, we have the opportunity to tease out what life is really about by encouraging one another. Despite the fear, despite the distractions, despite the setbacks, despite the fog of everyday life, to embrace those opportunities to be genuinely awake. I'm going to bust up some personal space right now. Can you look, turn to someone nearby and look at them? See if they're real. Are they real? Look closely at them. Can you see them? Are you awake enough? May we breathe with unconditional breath and remember that there are no unsacred places or unsacred people, but all can be a catalyst to awake our enchanted souls and open ourselves to the call that is on our lives every day as followers of Jesus. So this person that you just looked at as a real person, and to everyone you meet, I hope you can wish them the very thinnest of Christmases. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.